Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the HR Cartel podcast. I'm your host, Tim Dive. Thank you for joining me once more. Important things to discuss right now because there is a perfect storm approaching smaller employers, small businesses. And that is around all the change coming about and looking ahead for the next 5 to 10 years. If these changes firmly take hold, what does it mean for smaller employers? What is the Fair Work Ombudsman, what are the Fair Work Commission, what is the government telling us about what their intentions are for 5 years? These people in positions of power and in regulators, they do publish their intent. So we have to pay attention to that because that is the future for smaller employers and all employers really, but smaller employers are going to be the ones most impacted. And we'll talk about why I believe that is and what smaller employers really have to pay attention to. First off, let's talk about defining what we mean by smaller businesses, smaller employers, because there's confusion. And depending on what kind of context you're using that term in, small business, it determines what size of employer that you're talking about. And it can confuse a lot of smaller employers. I do want to use the term smaller employers. And what I mean by that is anyone who employs people under 200 staff. So if you've got a workforce of 200 staff or less, you're the business, you're the employer I'm talking about that is going to face this perfect storm. And frankly, you're already facing it. I'm not talking about what the Fair Work Commission would define as a small business employer, a 0 to 15 employees. Now, if the Fair Work Commission is talking about enterprise bargaining, they've got more sort of levels of smaller or small businesses, 0 to 20, for example, will get you a different approach to multi-employer bargaining. 20 to 50, you're still a smaller employer, but you've got another different approach to enterprise bargaining. And then you've got 50 and over, which means you're free to attack. You're free for unions to attack you and drag you into single interest bargaining. And it's up to you to prove otherwise that you shouldn't be included. And they've got multiple definitions of what a small business is. For me, it's simple as this. If you've got less than 200 employees, you are a smaller employer and you are at risk of all the future intentions of regulators, of unions and other groups in Australia. So let's talk about that. There's three key elements as to what is the perfect storm. The first element that you've got to get your head around is the HR profession itself. The HR profession largely has ignored small businesses, smaller employers, and so have smaller employers, you know, vice versa. They've ignored each other. But let's talk about the HR profession for the first bit. For at least the 20 years that I've been involved in this profession, in this game, it's been absolutely drilled into me coming up and learning in the foundations that I was exposed to in my earlier days in HR that there's a massive ego problem. It's a huge ego in HR in the profession. Back then, it was all about controlling as much as you can control. It was all about getting a seat at the table. They wanted to be shoulder to shoulder with the most important decision makers in any business and always involved in every conversation, at every board meeting, sitting with the CEO, making, you know, influencing decisions and that sort of thing. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but the dogged approach that the HR profession had towards that put it on a pathway of ignoring smaller employers. Now, why is that, right? That's because larger employers, so more than 200 staff, these larger employers are the ones that are driving the career market, the job market for HR professionals. They're the ones that have the luxury, the revenue, the profit, the ability to actually sustain heavily resourced and heavily funded HR departments. They fragment the profession. You've now got training and development and recruitment and generalists and remuneration and benefits specialists and mobilization. And it's all broken up into specific specializations now. That's all been done in larger businesses. And that has given HR people more choice, more selection, more avenues to take their career down, to express their interests and that sort of thing. Of course, HR is focused on larger businesses because that's where their jobs are. That's where they're getting paid the most. That's where they're getting more opportunities and so on. Not hard to figure out, right? But what's happened? For at least 20, 30 years, this profession has ignored smaller businesses. And smaller businesses have been fine to be ignored for some of that time, in my view. A lot of the regulations have small business exemptions and all this sort of stuff. That's almost over. That's going to come to an end. The over-regulation that larger employers have had to face, hence the reason they've had to fragment the sector of the profession of HR and have specializations to keep up with the over-regulation and get through it, that's now filtering down to smaller employers. Number two in the perfect storm, number two of the three elements, of the perfect storm, the smaller business HR mindset. Why do smaller businesses and their owners and entrepreneurial types hate HR? Let's face it, they do. In my 20 years, the group that has hated HR the most and has avoided HR people and HR practices the most, entrepreneurial types, small business founders and small business owners. And that's because they look at HR people as coming in, changing the way they work, changing what has worked to get them successful to this point. And they believe that they've got better relationships with people anyway. They can do it themselves. That's what they genuinely believe. Are they correct? My experience would say, no, they're not correct at all. There's a bit of a delusion with especially the entrepreneurial types who are founders, who develop a team, start with two or three, get to 10, get to 15, get to 30. There's a real delusion in their capability when it comes down to people and mobilizing people towards ideas and that sort of thing. Not always. Of course, there are people who are very good at that, and that's why they're so successful with their ventures. But typically speaking, they're not great at it. It's just a bit of a delusion carried over from when they were so small with three, four, or five people where they could have relationships with every person and everyone seemed happy because they could get access to you. When you're 20, 30, 40, and 50, that's not the case anymore. And you're not good enough to manage that many people. You just can't do it. It's impossible to do if you're going to have any success in your business. That smaller employer, smaller business HR mindset has to change. You have to stop mistrusting HR. You have to stop assuming it has no value to offer you. Now, let's look at those two elements. Number one, number two, the HR profession largely at fault. And it's because it's ignored an entire segment. And the smaller business mindset, rightly, because of the impact that larger business work environments have had on how HR people value their interests, their activities, it's that they're so misaligned that smaller business HR has developed this belief that HR doesn't fit with our business. So they've moved apart from each other. Now, that's number two elements of this perfect storm. Let's bring in number three. The regulatory regime, both federal and state in Australia. Let's talk about federal first. Look no further than the statement of intent from the Fair Work Ombudsman, Anna Booth, in response to the IR Minister, Tony Burke's request, written request to her to create what he calls and what they call the left side of politics call and unions call tripartism, which is essentially putting unions at the same decision-making table and with the same power to design workplaces as the employer, the owner of the company, and the government. Okay, that's what their intention is. And it's happening. They've started it. We're 2 years into it, and the government appointed about 6 months ago the new Fair Work Ombudsman, who they knew would underpin their beliefs in this area and go about trying to establish it all. And she is, right? She is. This isn't an attack on Anna Booth, by the way. I want to be clear about that. It's just the regulatory regime that we face now. There's a five-year term in that position. So for the next 5 years, we know what the Fair Work Ombudsman is trying to do, right? The Fair Work Ombudsman has stated that they are setting up pathways into criminal law. So pathways inside their operations, inside their workforce, they're setting up checks and red flags and things like that in order to highlight an employer and put them straight into a criminal law path. That's the wage theft stuff that they've been talking about. You're going to spend time in jail if you commit intentional wage theft. The ombudsman is set on that. People are going to go to jail. When I say people, we're talking about directors. We're talking about young leaders. There's going to be enormous penalties. Maybe jail time too. I don't know. Who knows? Let's see how this plays out. To HR people who knowingly operated in the company and let them conduct wage theft. Yeah, that's all coming. Now, all you got to do is look back at the last 2 years and you'll see the Secure Jobs Better Pay Act, the Secure Jobs Better Pay Bill, the Closing Loopholes 1 Bill, the Closing Loopholes 2 Bill. That's the federal government's intentions. Pretty clear right there, right? Now, they're not going to stop. There's more changes coming. And we'll talk about that in a bit more detail so you can see exactly what that looks like if we extrapolate out. But that regulatory regime, we know what the intention is. The intention is to enormously over-regulate workplaces. That's the third element of this perfect storm. So let's recap on all those three. Number one, the HR profession has ignored smaller employers. And by smaller employers, we're not talking about 0 to 15 employees, what the Fair Work Commission would define. We're talking about businesses with under 200 staff. That profession has ignored those businesses for decades. Number two, smaller businesses have hated HR. They don't want them in their companies. They don't see the value of bringing in a person who's going to change the way they operate. They don't trust it. They don't like it. And they think, a founder thinks they can do it better themselves anyway. And number three is this extremely active regulator, the extremely active government who is hell-bent on interfering with workplaces and imposing enormous penalties and risks, including sending directors to jail if they get wages wrong and compliance wrong and this sort of thing. Those are the three elements that smaller employers have to realize they're facing. That's the perfect storm. Evolution is required. There's no doubt about that. Smaller employers will not be enjoying the holiday they've enjoyed previously under these new governments and new regulators. Not going to happen. Let's look at all the changes that are happening. Let's go. So Secure Jobs Better Pay. That was what the federal government brought about December 2022, I think it was. So we're going back about a year and a half or so. What was in there? All the changes that was brought about there, we're talking about enterprise bargaining agreements and being able to bring in multiple employers into one agreement. And by that, the government allowing unions to apply to the Fair Work Commission to say, I think employer A is the same as employer B in whatever way. Therefore, employer B, who had no part negotiating terms, is now going to be dragged into our coverage of our EBA over here. And in this way, they can cover whole industries, essentially, right? I haven't seen it happen yet, but that can happen. We had removal of fixed-term contracts. So you can no longer have a contract that ends and then gets extended and renegotiated at that point in time and then extend again and all those things. Or maximum-term contracts, some companies would call them. They're different contracts, but pretty much the same thing. You can't use them anymore the way that you were able to before. They also, a key element of Secure Jobs Better Pay was, you know, pay secrecy. Removing pay secrecy. And also there was a lot of fool around the same job, same pay stuff. If you had an enterprise agreement on a site and you would use labor hire to come in and pay them at the award rate to whatever it is that were lower than the enterprise agreement, a union can now apply to the commission to get an order to make you pay the same inflated rate as the EBA, even though that employee doesn't negotiate away any terms at all, and they're only there temporarily and that sort of thing. It's a way of stopping employers from what they called undercutting workers, which, you know, who knows how much of that was really happening. The government themselves said very little. That wasn't the intention of it. What did that approve? What did that produce? What did that first amendment to the Fair Work Act produce? It brought about the ability, mainly the ability, for all people to know what everyone's getting paid. That's essentially what it produced. And we'll look at Closing Loopholes 1, Closing Loopholes 2 as well, because we can start to see what the government's strategy is here. So the first change about 18 months ago was essentially opening up the books. all workers were now allowed and protected by law to talk about pay, which, you know, good or bad, who cares, doesn't really matter, but that's what the law change was. You could not have contract terms that said that you know, keep confidential wages payable and that sort of stuff to each other. So now employees can now sit around a table and just say, I get paid X, I get paid Y, I get paid Z, why is it different? It brought about the power to remove those fixed term contracts, so you couldn't just extend people, you know, with no end. It does have an end, of course, because it's a fixed term, but you can't just go on fixed term after fixed term after fixed term and not commit to that person long term. And the EBA changes brought in the ability for unions to get wider coverage of wages they negotiated with one party and cover 3, 4, or 5 parties with it. So it was all about opening the books, showing people who gets paid what, and allowing people to openly talk about it without any risk at all to them. That's what Closing Loopholes 1 did. Sorry, Secure Jobs Better Pay. That's what Secure Jobs Better Pay did. Let's go to Closing Loopholes 1. This is around December 2023. Closing Loopholes 1. So if you remember, Closing Loopholes bill was submitted. It was an enormous bill. Not enough time for the Senate to get their head around. So they kicked it out. And the independent senators played chess a little bit with the Labor Party. And they split their bill in two and resubmitted it in to be voted on. What that did was force the government to allow the bill to be split, because an intelligent government isn't going to vote against their own bill. They certainly tried to, I think, from memory. But in any case, the bill got split. So Closing Loopholes 1 was voted on and passed in December 2023. Now, what did that do? That brought about the same job, same pay stuff. It brought about wage theft penalties. So essentially, and other things as well. But essentially what Closing Loopholes 1 did was it further fixed wages, right? It aimed to fix wages. It also aimed to bring in very heavy penalties and even jail time for employers who don't comply with those wage levels. So Secure Jobs Better Pay brought open the books and got everyone in the workforce talking about how much they're being paid. Closing Loopholes 1 then brought in penalties, and so more wage fixing opportunities, and brought in penalties for employers who tried to avoid those higher wages and paying compliantly. Closing Loopholes Bill 2 was then voted on and approved earlier this year. I think it was in February, maybe. Don't quote me on that. Now, what did that produce? That brought about casual conversion, more rules around casuals being able to become permanent or demand they become permanent. It changed the definition of casuals. It changed the definition of contractors. It's now being produced, the gig economy and contractors. It's putting now terms and conditions and minimum terms of engagement on those gig workers. So you can see what it's done there is it starts to remove the ability for employers to use flexible workforces. Not flexible working arrangements, that's different. Flexible workforces, flexible work types. Contracting, casuals, and gig economy workers. It's removed them or put enormous restrictions around them for employers and taken them off the table. So now you've got this, you can see this strategy, right? You can see what the federal government's doing in order to drive wages up, protect employees legally to talk to each other. And it's essentially what they're doing is creating union organizers amongst your workforce that aren't union organizers necessarily. Get together, talk about what you're being paid, and then they're mandating the wage theft provisions and all this sort of stuff. And then they're, of course, removing all the flexible work options off the table for employers. That's the strategy, right? We can see that. So they've driven costs up. Let's look at the state-based stuff. Let's take Queensland for an example. I'm based in Queensland. I'm based here at the sunny Gold Coast, the beautiful Gold Coast. The construction industry, as we know it nationally, is fucked. We all know that. Thousands and thousands of companies going belly up, can't compete, costs too high, too many restrictions, margins too slim, employees cost too much. All that stuff. Perfect storm in that industry, right? In that specific industry. Much of what we're talking about today. But let's just look at Queensland for an example. If you believe the commentators, this Labor government in Queensland is on their way out. They're not going to survive this year or the next election. Now, what's happening? The Queensland government using its state authority, its state power, has driven up the cost of construction projects. And they've done that by implementing what's called, I think it's like Building Industry Best Practice Code or something. Something like that. Best Industry Practice Code, something like that. Whatever that means. BIPC, I think, is what it's called. But essentially, it drives the cost up by about 30%. That's the summary of it. Now, what does that mean? If I go back about, let's say, 6-7 years, I remember I was helping an organization, a construction-based business here on the Gold Coast, to cost up the wages and things for a government project in Brisbane. I won't name the project, but it was a government project in Brisbane, a big project in Brisbane that was kicking off. It's almost finished now, so you probably, if you're in Queensland, you might know what I'm talking about. But I costed up the rates and things in there. Now, back then, a trade assistant, so a labourer, right? A TA, a labourer, a trade assistant, unskilled. Well, you wouldn't say unskilled labour, but yeah, not a qualified person. Just giving a hand on a construction site. Back then, that EBA was going to cost for that person, that labourer, about $195,000 a year. Unheard of, right? Unheard of. We were scratching our heads, going, "Hang on, have we got this project right? Have we costed this up correctly? Is this correct?" Time and time again, it just produced the same outcomes. The cost of wages in that project was enormous. That's carried through, right? The Queensland government forces builders and people that want to work on construction on their construction and infrastructure projects to have agreements with the CFMEU. They're driving costs up. So, for example, a traffic controller in Queensland who will do 2 days of training stands to receive $217,000 per annum as their wage. That's a traffic controller who tells cars when they can come and go, who tells pedestrians when they can come and go. Important job. I'm not downplaying the importance of that role. It's a critical position on a construction site. 2 days training. You've got the ticket to go and get a job. You don't really need experience necessarily. It's not one of those roles. But you can do 2 days training and you're now getting $217,000. The average construction worker wage on a Queensland construction site on government projects is going to be about $200,000. Now, that impacts every sector, right? Yes, I'm talking about being in Queensland. I'm talking about, you know, government projects and that sort of thing. So the short-sighted view of that is, well, who cares? They're getting good money, right? Good on them. The project's going to end. They're going to go to a new project. They probably won't get as much money. So who cares? Yeah, maybe. But you're wrong. This impacts every single sector, every single employer. Enterprise bargaining agreements, I won't name the companies, that are happening right now in Queensland, producing rates for clerical staff close to $200,000. This is the cost of that the Queensland government itself is driving in this state for wages for workers. That impacts every other sector because everyone uses a clerical staff member. Most businesses have clerical requirements. They have clerks, they have admins, that sort of thing. Tradespeople on construction sites. People who need their houses built. There are smaller builders that need tradespeople. The mining sector, for example, that's another one. Now, I'm not going to say the mining sector is the victim because they make billions and billions of dollars. However, good luck getting anyone to go work in mines in Queensland, which is a very heavy coal mining contingent. Good luck getting anyone off the East Coast who's on these projects for the government getting paid $220,000 a year to go and sit in your shitty mining camp, eating shitty food for a week on, week off, dealing with garbage out there when they're making more money here, maybe even up to double. That industry is going to be impacted, which means regional areas will be impacted. So it flows on, right? The point is all smaller employers have to attract workers from the same pool. It will drive up what you have to pay everywhere. Okay, that's just what happens. You know, let's look, you know, construction, for example. I was talking to a friend of mine not long ago. Yeah, he's in construction. He works in, steel fixing, I believe. But, you know, he's done crane operations. He's done all sorts of things. So I don't know what particular job he was doing on this one site. Hutchison Builders was a massive, they're Australia's largest builder, Hutchison Builders. If you don't know who Hutchison Builders is, you're just not in construction or you haven't been around it. This friend of mine worked for a smaller business. They went belly up on the project. They just could not afford to run the project. Now, what happens in that scenario, usually, is that Hutchison Builders, the principal contractor, will take on that company's staff. That's generally what will happen when you see agreements between subcontractors and the principal builders and that sort of thing. But it's a pretty common feature that you go belly up, you can't afford to run the project anymore, you put your company into administration, while the principal, the builder, the principal contractor will take on your staff and get the work completed for you. Now, Scott Hutchison, who's the head of that business, I was at a lunch not long ago, and he was talking about that industry and their requirement to do that. Now, he's confirming they're doing that far more frequently than you might expect. This is the impact, right? This is the impact that these decisions that get made by the state level have on smaller employers. The Labor government in Queensland is heavily tied to the CFMEU. They're making decisions influenced by the CFMEU about construction, and this suits Tier 1 builders as well. This is the last point I probably want to make on this, because this is really important to get your head around. You might be thinking, if this is so bad, why aren't these big companies lobbying harder against these unions and the government and that sort of thing? There's a reason for that, and I don't want to be too conspiratorial here, but we'll get to that. Now, these larger employer groups, they do go against it. They do say, we don't like this. They do say, you're having fake consultations with us, and no matter what we say, you're going to make these rules anyway, and all this sort of stuff. The reality is, it doesn't really impact them that much. It just doesn't. In fact, it's in the interest. If you're a larger business that wants to grow and get bigger and that sort of thing, this is just a commercial decision. Let's wear the cost for a little bit. Let's take on more than we're used to taking on. Let's get through this rough period where all these companies are going belly up and folding. And let's play with the union a little bit until, of course, it gets to a point where they're trying to push for something that we just will not be able to accept, at which point they will push back, they will fight hard, and the union won't win that argument. It's in their interest, right? Because the more of these smaller companies that go belly up and can't compete in these sectors anymore, the more market share these bigger companies take. This goes back to the point of the perfect storm smaller employers are facing. Middle Australia, no one gives a shit about. Smaller employers are full of middle Australia. You've got to have a good middle class. You have to have a strong middle class to get the country out of the shit when the regulators fuck it up. You have to have that. You're the ones being attacked by this, and you don't know yet. You don't know yet. But when it goes too far and the big tier ones go, hang on, no more. We're not agreeing to any of this. We're not agreeing to this bargaining agreement. We're going to go into a gridlock here. We're going to hold out. We're going to starve you out for 2 years. We're going to lock you out of our sites. We can wear it. We've got the money. We'll take on the challenge. We'll take on the battle, whatever. That's the bit where the union starts. They see their members in workplaces being shut down, mine sites being shut down, put into care and maintenance, projects not proceeding. That's when the unions go, oh, hang on, shit, let's back off a bit here. Do you think they're going to stop, though? No, they're not going to stop. They go to the smaller employers. That's where the attention's going to go. And that's where we're going to see things like the flexibilities that smaller employers get today start to erode away. Things like the Small Business Fair Dismissal Code, for example, where, I'll be clear. There's no agenda that I've read by any government or any regulator anywhere that say they're going to remove the Small Business Fair Dismissal Code. I'll be clear on that. But let's just use it as an example. The Small Business Fair Dismissal Code is where if you've got less than 15 employees, with some other terms and conditions around that, but if you've got less than 15 employees, instead of having 6 months qualifying period or probation period, as most employers call it, you've got 12. You don't have to pay redundancy. There's all these different exemptions that you've got. And there's other things like the Small Business Fair Dismissal Code that smaller employers enjoy. But those things will be eroded. They're going to go away. And this is where the evolution comes in. The evolution that's required, because smaller businesses are not equipped to face this regulatory regime. They're not equipped for it. If this federal government stays in power, and there's a point to make here too, if they're so bad, why would they be voted in? Very good point. But let's sit on that for a second. Most voters in Australia are employees. They're workers. This all sounds great to them. So the workplace relations battle, the battlefield, the battle happening in Australian workplaces is not all that relevant to voters. They are getting the benefits of this. So it wouldn't surprise me if this government stays in for another term. And I'll go back to the evolution requirement. And I'll use a bit of a metaphor here. And regardless of what you think about the theory of revolution and this sort of thing, whether it clashes with your religious beliefs or whatever it is, look, bear with me, all right? Just go with me on this. Let's say that the Homo sapiens of the world, the human beings, right? The evolution of human beings, the Homo sapiens, we've gone through this evolution. And let's say that the tier ones are the Homo sapiens, the tier one operators out there. They've been through the Ice Age, the Stone Age, the Iron Age, the Technology Age, and all these ages. And they've come through those, they've evolved, they've learned, they've developed, they've adapted. They're now this big functioning major thing, right? They're this enormous thing that exists. And they're far more advanced. Now, let's say smaller businesses are akin in that timeline to the great apes that Homo sapiens and the human strain split away from at some point in the past. Now, these guys are just approaching their Stone Age of evolution. They're starting to learn how to use sticks and rocks, tools to break open coconuts and to spear fish hanging from a tree and this sort of stuff. That's where the smaller employer is in terms of capability compared to that big Homo sapien tier one. Now, I use that metaphor because that shows you the evolution that smaller employers have in front of them. They're not going to have the luxury of time and going through these Stone Ages and technology ages and gradually learning and developing as they go along. They don't have that luxury. This regulatory framework requires them to start operating just like tier ones at some point very soon. You're facing jail time. You're facing fines up to $8 million. That's just for wage theft. That's just for getting your wages wrong. Now, even the Fair Work Ombudsman gets their wages wrong. Even their advisors give you the wrong advice and cause mistakes. Even Tony Burke, the Minister for IR, even his department was subject to an underpayment claim, I think, last year. Now, even the people who make the rules don't get it right. They're exempt. They're not going to jail. You're going to go to jail. It doesn't matter that you're a smaller employer. It has in the past. It's not going to matter at some point soon. This is the evolution that you have to face. This is all the perfect storm. You can't bury your head any longer. If you're a smaller employer, I guarantee you, your exemptions will erode. It's going to happen. You've got to pay attention to what's going on. Now, let's leave it at that. Enough doom and gloom for you for today. I hope you love coming to my podcast here and walking away depressed. It's not my intention, but hey, this is what we're dealing with. The evidence is all there. You just got to take stock of what's happening around us. Pop up our heads and look ahead 5 years. Let's extrapolate out. Let's expect this government is going to be in for another term. How much damage can be done here to smaller employers? Only that answer. You're going belly up all over the place. I hate that. I don't like that. But smaller employers have the highest need for HR capability and they're ignored. Smaller employers have to find a model that works for them, a model that suits them, where they can have advanced HR and IR capability brought into their business to survive this need for evolution. There's no doubt about that. Let's talk about very quickly the gap that's out there, because HR consulting firms are not all the same. are very different. You can have a HR person that sits in a big tier one business, a big BHP Billiton business for 10 years, and they come out and they've had this escalation of responsibilities and all these sort of things, and on a resume, they look good. They look real good. Put that person in front of a small business owner and watch the eyes roll. Watch how different their mindsets are. Look how non-commercial that HR person's going to be. Look at what that HR person's going to bring in to your small business workforce and that environment, and try to impose on your people. Try to tell them what they need to think is important, what they need to hold valuable. Put them through training courses and mentoring programs that just take them away from what they've got to get done every day, and it gets in their way. It's not fit for purpose. And this is the problem. You've got that element too, right? You've got that element happening in Australia right now, where the consulting companies are either doing one of two things. They're either selling you templates, which you can just download for free anyway. And some of these consulting firms just download stuff from the Fair Work website or from the YARI, the Australian Human Resources Institute. And they've got all templates there for you. You can just change them, change the wording, and start to sell these templates to companies. I mean, they'll get you on a minimum subscription model and a gold package and a bronze package and a silver package and all that sort of stuff. And that's a race to the bottom for HR consultancies. They're not doing anything of any value. There's nothing customized and tailored. They might say it's customized templates for your business, but it's not really. It's just templates they're selling you. And that's easy to sell, because traditionally, that's all smaller businesses have had to really worry about, making sure that the communication's right, the correspondence is right, there's record keeping and that sort of thing. Not anymore. That is not going to suffice for the future. You have far more obligations now to keep you out of jail. You need genuine capability now. You need advanced industrial relations understanding to see the risks, to know what the risks are, to give you the right advice about what you need to model in your business, how you need to pay people, how you need to check for your compliance, how to run your staff, how to manage their working hours, their start times, finish times, how to model their rosters and cycles, all these things, all result in wage theft risk when you get it wrong. The penalty is too high right now. The penalty is jail time. So the advanced need is there. There's a massive gap in disparity between what HR can offer and what small businesses need. Find the solution that works for you. You need to bring in advanced IR HR capability. And on that note, go to www.workplaceas.com. Got a question? Send it through. Give us a call. Talk to us. The risk is real. It's getting worse. Just reach out. I lied last time. I said let's leave it there, but I'm telling the truth now. Until next time, keep a tight workplace, and we'll talk soon.